Good morning, everyone. Thank you to the two AVGishas for getting that sorted out. It's nice to be sitting this morning with our rather intimate group on just a lovely, soft spring morning. So, last month I was out in Arizona, and I had a chance for a really wonderful outdoor day. There was a birding festival, and one of the birding trips involved a small group going out on a beautiful river, the Verde River, and we went out in kayaks with a birding guide. So as you can imagine, that was kind of a marvelous thing. And a day on the river is always a treat, especially this kind of lush river corridor that you get sometimes in the high desert. And over the course of the day, we saw a lot of birds, and we learned a lot about birds. But in fact, we learned even more about the whole environment of the river, the whole ecosystem. It's hard to look at birds and their lives without also bringing in everything around them, the habitat, the weather, insects, and other animals. One of the things I got a new appreciation for on this trip was that birds that are common and abundant, birds that we see a lot of in different places around the country, like sparrows or robins or red-winged blackbirds, are very tolerant species in that they can live and thrive in really a wide range of habitats. But other birds are rare because they have certain very precise requirements to survive and to reproduce. So a unique set of conditions has to be in place for them. These conditions I think of as kind of a net of Indra, this complex web of life in which all parts touch and impact each other. For example, one of the things I learned about on this trip was this kind of aquatic plant that grows only in the shallows, only on the shady side of the river. But in fact, this plant, though seemingly insignificant, is essential for certain insects and young fish. So thus it impacts the lives of birds and the whole river system. So being on a trip like this, you really come away with a sense of wonder and also a deep respect for all the constituents of the whole, how they have evolved and adapted to live in a challenging terrain, what they do to survive and reproduce and continue. So it was an important reminder that even the smallest things matter, that the most humble or seemingly lowly things have their rightful and important place in the order of things and are worthy of our attention and respect. So this, of course, resonates deeply with our Zen practice. A lot of what we learn through practice is about respect and about attention. So what are we respecting? Actually, we're learning to respect each moment, whatever we are meeting in that moment. We're respected by paying attention, by being sensitive to what is actually there. So that moment might be a mind state that we encounter during Zazen. Maybe some anxiety or sadness or boredom. It might be a physical state we encounter. Fatigue, that kind of little tweak in the knee or in the back that we noticed during Zazen. Or it might be the crush of people in traffic when we walk out the door onto Broadway. So the practice really challenges us. Could we come to see each moment, really any moment, as completely worthy of our attention? So attention, of course, is something we hear a lot about in Zen. It's really fundamental to our practice. So why talk about it this morning? Because if we look closely at our life, we'll see that this is actually quite difficult for us. Certain conditions trigger us to go on automatic pilot, to fall into habitual patterns of reactivity, or just to spin off into our stories that we tell ourselves, all the mental fabrications that can be there. If you look at this, we tend to do this around routine tasks, conditions that don't appear interesting to us. It's a great place to space out. Or conditions that we don't like or that we experience fear around tend to be places also where we fall out of attention. So you can explore this for yourself, because a useful place to learn something about the mind is to start to notice where we do tune out, where we're not present, where we get our buttons pushed and fall into sort of an unconscious reactivity. It's an important step in practice when we really start to see that. Joko Beck talked a lot to her students about the power of attention. She's kind of well known for one of her teaching phrases, which was this. She reminds us that a zendo is not a place for bliss or relaxation, but a furnace for the combustion of our egoistic delusions. What tools do we need to use? Only one. We've all heard of it, yet we use it very seldom. It's called attention. So some of our emotional states may be places where we tune out or lose our ability to be present, kind of lost in the stories the egoic mind likes to tell itself. Being present to the moment, respecting the moment, means being present to ourselves, not hiding or kind of denying what's really there. I recently, on the street, ran into a work acquaintance, and we were just chatting a little bit, and he mentioned that he was going through a divorce. And it was clear that there was a lot of pain there, that he just, at least in that moment, couldn't acknowledge even to himself. A couple times he was very tense around this, and a couple times he kept saying, well, you know, can't look back, just have to move on. So we too can sometimes experience this unwillingness to actually name what is there, to be with it. If we deny that we're sad or hurt or fearful, I think sometimes we think that then we don't have to be that person, and we can actually be the person we want to present ourselves as. So we unconsciously armor ourselves so we don't have to see or feel what is there. There's nothing intimate about that because we've separated from ourselves and from our experience. So our practice helps us to see that all these moments, from the most mundane to the most difficult or emotionally challenging, are worthy of attention and clear seeing. For one simple reason, they are what is happening. They're what is here. So I'd mentioned the river trip that I had been on in Arizona, and not too long after that, I had a conversation with a Native American potter from the Hopi Indian tribe who was displaying some of her pottery at a gallery. Hopi pottery is really it's very distinctive and refined, and her work was just stunning to look at. And I was talking to her, and she started telling me a little bit about how she creates her pottery and what is involved with it. And with that, this whole other aspect opened up to me, not just the beauty of the finished work, but what's behind it. So she described how she makes pottery in the very traditional ways with traditional patterns that have been handed down for many generations. The plant dyes can only come from certain plants. They're harvested only in certain months and at certain cycles of the moon. The clay is taken only from certain places. It has to be handled in a very carefully prescribed way. The rocks used for firing the pottery must come from certain rivers, and again are handled in certain careful ways before the firing and after it. So all the steps along the way matter and are valued. So in Zen, this kind of attention and care would be called giving life to life. So most of us are not involved in this level of artisanal craftsmanship. You know, we live in a consumer culture where we buy things ready-made from stores, and we tend to bring a utilitarian or a practical view to a lot of what we do. Our culture values speed and efficiency and convenience. So even though we live in this world and not the world of a Hopi potter, there's something to be seen here for each of us in how we move through our day, how we do the work that needs to be done. There's a sensibility that comes from being present to what is right here, to being intimate with the ingredients of our life. And our Zen practice gives us a vehicle and a means to tap into the sense of wholeness and integrity that this way of being implies. We too can give our full attention to whatever tools we're using, to how we bring things together, to how we serve the task. You know, I saw this recently here at the Zendo. Miyoko Sensei and I have been meeting with the students who are going to be taking Jukai this summer, and we've started working on Rakusus. One of the points I kind of mentioned to the group when we started that we describe these scheduled meetings we have where the group comes together as sewing sessions. You know, but in fact, a lot of what we do is, well, we do ironing, measuring, drawing lines on fabric, starting over, drawing lines on fabric, cutting, pinning. So I know for myself, when I sewed my first rakusu, the sewing of that became a vivid teaching to me in hindsight, really. How our concepts and ideas about what we're doing can get in the way of our ability to be fully present to what is there. So the first time I sewed a rakusu, which was a number of years ago, I remember distinctly feeling that all this measuring and pinning was kind of a pain in the neck, kind of this tedious prep work before we got to the main event, the real event, which was the sewing, the actual stitching. This was a lot of deluded thinking. I didn't realize it at the time, but I look back on it and I was like, I missed it. I really missed it on that. Instead of giving life to life, you could say that this was killing life. Because when it comes to making a rakusu, drawing lines and pinning and folding aren't the preliminaries. They're it, just as much as each actual stitch that we make. It was a really great teaching for me on how easily we miss the moment, don't respect the moment, because our concepts of what we're doing or what's important get in the way. So, as part of our practice, it's useful to ask ourselves, what concepts do we have about what we're doing or who we are that get in the way of actually experiencing life, of fully appreciating our life? Yuan Wu, the 12th century Chan monk who gave the commentaries in the Blue Cliff Record, said that there are no mundane things outside of Buddhism, and there is no Buddhism outside of mundane things. Practice is always right here. Dogen Zenji, of course, wrote a lot about this. Do you remember what he says in his instructions to the cook? In that text, Dogen is giving some specific instructions to the tenzo, or the cook, at a Zen monastery. Of course, his instructions are really for all of us. Dogen tells us not to fragment our attention, but to see what each moment calls for. He tells us to handle even a single leaf of a green in such a way that it manifests the body of the Buddha, and that this in turn allows Buddha to manifest through the leaf. He writes that if we have only wild grasses with which to make a broth, not to disdain them. If we have ingredients for a cream soup, not to be delighted, but to work with everything with the same sincerity, to handle it respectfully, as he puts it, as if it were for the emperor. We could paraphrase Dogen with the wild grasses and say that if the ingredients we as cooks have are illness or disappointment or difficulty in any form, our practice is not to push those away or say that we'll make a better soup someday in the future when we have better materials to work with. Nor do we let ourselves become careless or inattentive because of our opinions about the worthiness or unworthiness of the ingredients. the Zen peacemakers remind us to use all the ingredients of our life. That whatever our experience is, even the experiences that we would not have chosen, that are not to our liking, that those can still be a Dharma gate. It's something to practice with, to see its nature, to see how it is not solid but changing, to see that it is not self. We can come to see the wild grasses clearly and handle them respectfully and attentively to make the broth. As Bernie Glassman puts it, the Zen cook knows that every aspect is an ingredient of the supreme meal, which is our life. In his instructions to the cook, Dogen also talks about something that is important for us to cultivate. He's really talking about our shin, or the Japanese term, our heart mind. He's talking about the spirit and how we relate to what we do and what we encounter. And Dogen reminds us that a bodhisattva, an awakening being working towards the benefit of others, should try to maintain three mental attitudes. Dai Shin, translated as vast mind or magnanimous mind. Roshin, or parental mind. And Ki Shin, or joyful mind. So here's Uchiyama Roshi talking about Dogen's magnanimous mind. He describes it as like an ocean or a mountain, calm and steady, yet accepting and nourishing countless beings and situations without differentiation. The ocean is serene because it accepts the many rivers without resisting. I especially like that last phrase, that accepts the many rivers without resisting. This is a spacious mind, a receptive mind, mind that's clear and stable enough to see what's happening and spacious enough to receive it. It's a respectful mind in that nothing is left out. It's a mind that experiences the self connected to all things, looks on everything equally as my life, this one life. Then Dogen talks about Roshin, or parental mind. Uchiyama Roshi uses the term nurturing mind. So the term Roshin is kind of related to Roshi. In a literal sense, it means old mind, the way Roshi means senior teacher or old teacher. And it's said that this mind of Roshin, said to be related to the attitude of a kind of a kindly, caring grandparent. In the commentaries on some of the koans, we sometimes hear a teacher described as having grandmotherly kindness in their teaching, meaning that no matter how deluded the student or the monk is, the teacher meets them and offers words to guide them. This is Roshin, or parental mind. And it would be an evidence here at the Zendo. So even today, we have various service positions where literally we serve the Sangha by keeping time for Zazen, leading the chanting, preparing the food, or being a server at the midday meal. All situations where this parental mind, this mind of caring, can really come to the fore. It's the heart of the bodhisattva, the awakening being. We take care of the world of all that we encounter as our life. It's a deep respect for the moment. The third area that Dogen speaks to is this Kishin, or joyful mind. So is Dogen telling us that we're somehow supposed to be happy and joyful all the time? Well, I'm not sure that that's really, really going to it. Uchiyama Roshi again describes this as the joy that comes from deep in our hearts, even in the midst of difficulty, that arises from the inside of Zazen, that we live together with all beings and are not separate. The Buddha also spoke about this joyful mind. He said that the Dharma itself is the most subtle joy, but also the greatest joy. So this Kishin doesn't have much to do with getting happy through material means. It's the joy of practicing the Buddha way, the joy of the opportunity to practice the teachings and bring them to life through our own life. So this Kishin has the feeling of kind of, to me, of like a quiet glow of non-separation, of intimacy that stabilizes and brightens the mind. So we cultivate these joyful, vast, and nurturing spirits or attitudes. And gratitude naturally arises. And with that gratitude comes care for all beings and respect for whatever our life brings us, moment by moment.